Everyone's asleep.
Everyone. All right, welcome back. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We broadcast live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And all the archives, including many other shows that I do appear on. I think I'm doing a couple shows next week and have done a few this week as well, are archived there on the Vinnie on Other Shows page. So, I'm actually kind of a better guest than I am a host sometimes. Like, have you noticed that, Melon? Well, like when you're the host and you've got the responsibilities and stuff like that, you're not really quite as on your game as you are when people are asking you questions and looking to you for answers or whatever. I don't know what it is. It's weird.
Sure. Oh yeah.
there's a strange phenomenon in this world, eh? Okay. We kind of haven't discussed anything about near-death experiences. We've been talking about more important things. The issues of the world. And, oh, my God. Hey, wait, hold on a second. I made a recording this morning off of a film called God Bless America. Have you ever heard of this film?
I'm not sure. It sounds familiar.
All right. Well, it's a Bobcat Goldthwait film. He's a guy who talks like this, you know. And he was in a number of films. I think Hot to Trot with John Candy as the talking horse or something like that. As Fred P. Chaney, quite a classic guy. And he made this film called God Bless America. And in the opening scenes, it's kind of like, if you had a fantasy, because everybody's had these fantasies, but they never go through with them, of changing society with a gun, you know? You have a look at all these scum on TV and all these really terrible, bad people that you think, man, why hasn't somebody killed that person yet? And this guy goes on a killing spree, and he goes and he kills all these really annoying people. it's quite interesting. I don't know. For me, I think I would describe the film as therapeutic.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. I have a friend of mine down in L.A. now writing a movie called Kill All the Lawyers. And I think that it may end up being popular.
Well, see, and this is the interesting thing, is that we're not actually going to physically go out and kill these people. We just fantasize about it. We never go through with it. But, and you know, somebody told me once, you know, Vinny, all these bad people out there, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and something, why hasn't anybody assassinated them yet? And I said, well, because only bad people assassinate people. And only a good person would want these bad people to be assassinated. You see what I'm saying? You know, you have a look at all the people that have been killed and executed and public executions and everything like that. None of them have been bad people. They've all been really good people that have been killed in public, you know, that kind of thing. I'd like to play this clip, actually, if I could, Melon, if you're up for just 60 seconds.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I think it's really poignant for our times to a large degree. Hold on, here we go.
I would defend their freedom of speech to tell uninspired, bigoted, blowjob, gay-bashing, racist, and rape jokes all under the guise of being edgy. But that's not the edge. That's what sells. They couldn't possibly pander any harder or be more commercially mainstream. Because this is the, oh no, you didn't say that generation, where a shocking comment has more weight than the truth. No one has any shame anymore, and we're supposed to celebrate it. I saw a woman throw a used tampon at another woman last night on network television, a network that bills itself as today's woman's channel. Kids beat each other blind and post it on YouTube. I mean, do you remember when eating rats and maggots on Survivor was shocking? It all seems so quaint now. I'm sure the girls from Two Girls, One Cup are going to have their own dating show on VH1 any day now. I mean, why have a civilization anymore if we no longer are interested in being civilized?
Yeah, man. We get so enraged with the BS we see all around us. And I had a thought over the break, Mel, and we were talking about you reckon the world's going in a good direction, and a lot of people would disagree with you. And I was thinking, what's the mitigating factor there? It's because all the people who think the world's going in a bad direction are listening to bad news all the time because it's what interests them. Like, if you think something's a threat, that's what you go for.
I've seen many people get addicted to different things on the internet or on the media, and they just get stuck on it, and you can't get them off of it. You know, it's like that's the only reality that's on the airwaves. So I've seen that happen to people.
It's a bad news society, really. And I'm just thinking, if we did start up a website like goodnewsforachange.com or whatever, I think it would be abysmally unpopular.
Well, you're right. There have been several attempts to start good news channels and good news programs, and they don't last very long. Go figure.
I mean, I think I've probably come the closest to making a successful good news show because we're talking about all the bad stuff, but we laugh and we have a good time while we're doing it.
I tell you. But, you know, generally speaking, things are going to change so dramatically now as the population goes down. You know, when you have too much of something, it's not worth very much. Humans are going to become very much more valuable in the future than they are now. We have, you know, the rich and the oligarchy think that there are too many of us. That's what brought in this eugenics. You know, eugenics really was aimed at all the poor people in the world.
Yeah. I mean, and here's the thing. It doesn't stem from science. It doesn't stem from sustainability. It stems from a hate of the human race and of itself. They just don't like humans. They look down on people that like they're cattle, like they're a commodity, like they're a waste of space. Like they don't have any value inherently as human beings anymore. And that's a psychopathic mentality.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, eugenics really got started with, I believe, Darwin's uncle began that whole thing.
Freud.
And Darwin, thought some of it was very good, but they were looking at it as you look at livestock. You know, you don't breed inferior livestock with superior livestock, and that's how they were looking at everything. If you want to help the human population, we've got to get rid of all the handicapped people, all the poor people, and then we'll make a better race of humans. Completely wrong.
Well,
it's like breeding cattle, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But then again, I think it's like humans can be, unlike most creatures, trained to do very, very different things for which their intended purpose was. I mean, humans, I think, are, like you said, malleable or masters of metamorphosis. And I had this a thought once about human potential. Let's say you have somebody who's potentially a genius, okay? So they are born and they have a 180 IQ or whatever. And you have two children like that. One is born to a psychologist at a university in Oxford in England, and his mother is a grand piano concert, you know, recital pianist or whatever, okay? And then you have the other genius is born to a warlord and a prostitute in Namibia. You'd create two entirely different individuals from the same potential due to their environment, wouldn't you? They wouldn't grow up to do the same thing or have the same interests. In fact, one would probably grow up becoming a murderer, a very intelligent murderer, and the other would go on to maybe understand the human condition and maybe write symphonies that would expand consciousness or something of that nature. You see what I'm saying? Like, human potential can be altered in any really way you choose. And when I was 14, I was a very violent kid for most of my life, and my school nurse or school counselor or whatever gave this pamphlet to my mother of ADHD symptoms. And it's like all these symptoms. You know how they say that anybody under the Alcoholics Anonymous list of could you be an alcoholic is technically an alcoholic, you know what I'm saying? And that's basically what was on this list, you know, all of my different personality traits. And I was like, whoa, that's very interesting. On that list of personality traits, there's highly intelligent, not able to sit around doing nothing for too long, and creative, etc. And they wanted to drug me. And my mother, instead of drugging me, she got a man who was about 40 years old named Derek Hayward, who was a lavender farmer, to come and hang out with me once a week. Suddenly, I kind of stopped being violent. I started plateauing. It wasn't the fact that I had something wrong, a chemical imbalance that needed to be corrected with a drug. It was the fact that I didn't have my dad around or any positive male role models in order to learn how to be a proper, good, decent man.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That was why I was going out of control. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that pamphlet is I saw those symptoms again on a slideshow presentation that I was being shown in university. And those symptoms were describing an entrepreneur.
I know. If you notice all the drug commercials, the symptoms, everybody's got some of those symptoms. They're actually creating new syndromes and new diseases so they can use the same old drugs. You know, America has a big problem with drugging its children, too, at schools and things. It's a very big problem here.
And now, the number one cause of death in America, suicide.
The number one cause of death?
The number one.
Really? I haven't seen that. Wow.
That news came out a little under a month ago or something like that. It surpassed heart disease and cancer and
suicide.
Everything, yeah. And you have a look at the side effects on these SSRI drugs, and it's like suicide. So many documented cases, it's just not even funny.
And the one thing they're pulling the cover over is, especially in America, and I'm sure it's with other countries, is the veterans have a very, very high suicide rate, and it's climbing, our veterans.
And guess who's on a hell of a lot of drugs as well at the behest of the Veterans Administration?
And so, you know, it's very sad what we're doing to these people, putting them in these situations that kind of ruin them for life, you know, for what? I ask you, for what? Why are we doing this? You know, so it's nice to be able to talk like this. Not too many radio shows I get to talk some of the other sides of things. So it's very, very refreshing for me in many ways, not just spiritual.
Yeah, I'm kind of like the Coca-Cola of radio show hosts. I'm really refreshing. I am the real thing. And I also have an excess of sodium so that you're thirsty after you listen to the show and you need to listen to another one.
Oh, good. Oh, that's a good one. Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I'm very sweet, too. I was thinking about, and I maybe want to ask you this. Mm-hmm. When you die, does your life actually flash before your eyes, like they say it does?
You know, it's a natural process of the transition. Many people can skip it. You're not forced to watch anything. There's no intelligence saying you've got to watch this. It's what we call now, when I didn't even know what it was when I had mine, but I had what they call a life review. And I found it fascinating and sad, and I found it enlightening. But there were parts of my life review, for some reason, I didn't want to look at. They were like doors I didn't want to open. And only later, through many visits back with the light and asking for clarification, did I finally open all the doors and see all the things. We all have things we repress. We all have things that we're not forced to look at or deal with. So a life review is actually a very natural process of death and the near-death experience. What people don't understand is it has a twofold purpose. The life review is something that you can learn immensely from if you're open to that at the time it happens. If you're someone that's ashamed of everything or hung up or totally deep steeped in fundamentalism, you may not have one of these type of experiences. You'll have your fundamentalist experience when you meet the light. But so you're downloading, you know, you're reviewing your life. Your life is being reviewed, all the little minute parts of it, the big parts of it. There are parts of it that you didn't think were heroic that were actually quite heroic. I got to see that. There are things we do every day that's quite heroic that we don't even think is heroic. And then the second fold, which is so important for the rest of us, is, and I was the first to point this out, is that that light we call at the end of the tunnel is our source matrix. There's only one of us here. There's only one life here. And when you're having your life review, it's like you're downloading your entire life experience into the big supercomputer. and then you pass through the light. Everybody that passes through that light benefits from the experience of all the rest of us, because there's no one of us that could hold all this information, could see everything, could hear everything. There's not one of us that could love everything, actually. It takes all of us. It's taken this many humans to come to this kind of a consciousness on planet Earth. And so every time you pass through the light in your death experience, you become more enlightened, more wise, and that shows in everything that I'm seeing in the world. So there's a twofold purpose to the life review, one personal and one universal that benefits us all.
And I think I was interviewing a guy the other day, and he asked me, you know, what I perceive life to be, and I said, well, I honestly don't know. What I reckon is that I'm having some kind of subjective experience, and I exist in this incarnation of Vinnie Eastwood, and I don't want to waste that experience. But other than that, I'm not 100% sure. I don't have a, you know how some people, they have solid belief. You know what I'm saying? Like, I believe that I will go to a lake of fire, or I believe that I will have virgins and pork when I die and all of that kind of stuff. I honestly don't know what I believe. In fact, I if I don't know something, then I don't really believe it.
It's true. Some things you have to actually experience and become aware of through your life experience or your death experience. For me, I didn't relate to any of this, nothing, psychics or anything, before my near-death experience. But I'm someone, and I'm the only one that they know of that's been studied, that I kept asking, like, what does this mean? What is it? What is it? What am I seeing? And I think that relates back to my early childhood. You know, as a child, my brother wanted bicycles for Christmas. I wanted a microscope. And I have been fascinated with microscopes, have several of them right now, high-quality microscopes. I love looking into things. So for me, the light experience, when I started seeing metaphors, because with the light experience, the source knows you like you've never, like no one you can imagine could ever know you. It's the source. And so it will speak to you at whatever level you're at, the idiot level, the genius level, the child level, the metaphor level, the religious level, whatever you're ready to relate to, the light will try to speak to you, you see? But I'm someone that had an early experience being raised in a Catholic boarding school. So we can talk about this after the break, but I can tell you what happened to me when I saw Jesus on the other side.
All right. Jesus on the other side with Mel and Thomas Benedict on after the break. On the other side, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Just like Jesus. All right, welcome back. Welcome back, everybody, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose a sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. I'm wondering, did the light tell you anything about importance of keeping a sense of humor about things?
Well, you know, humor is one of the greatest medicines and healers ever. It's universal throughout our species, and even animals have sense of humor. We're seeing, you know, it's really quite healing. If you don't have a sense of humor, you know, God help you.
Yeah, and what were we talking about just before the break?
We were talking about the life review, and that the source knows you like no one else and speaks at whatever level you're at. But in my case, I was the only one we know of that really kept asking, what am I seeing? Because I guess I was talking about my early experience with microscopes, and I love microscopes to this day, looking into everything. For me, when I did see the light, the first question I had for it was, I guess what any good atheist, I wasn't even an atheist, but I guess even an atheist would say, I mean, you were so impressed. I went, are you God? You know? I mean, oh boy. And then for a second there, I thought, oh, I'm going to get spanked for all the times I've, spoken badly about God and that sort of thing. And because the light speaks to you so that you will understand at whatever level you're at, the light said to me, when I asked that question, who is God? The light said to me, who and what is not God? And instantly I understood that if I wanted to tell you who and what God, the concept of God, the whole Godhead was, I would have to name every atom, everything in the universe, and that would take forever. So for me, what is not God, what is not part of the universe, it was the best answer for me. Now, what happened then was I saw this image of Jesus that blew me away, and I'm not a Christian. I'm still not a Christian. I have a big spiritual life, but not a religious life. And when I saw Jesus and I felt the energy, I mean the Christ energy, the Christ matrix, I really felt it for the first time in my life. I went, whoa. But then I asked the light, I said, but I don't believe in Jesus. What am I seeing? And the light then educated me on what we were playing. What was playing back was my earliest memories, being raised in Catholic boarding school and being an altar boy. And that was my, we have these hardwired images inside ourselves from our youth that are hardwired in. And so that was my own experience playing out. But I tell you, I did discover that what people talk about, the Christ energy, the Christ aspect, is in every human, as the light explained to me. It's the highest aspect of every human. It could be the Buddha light, the Krishna light. It doesn't have to be the Christ light. It's the highest aspect that humanity has manifested to date, which is amazing. It's why people love each other. It's why people save each other. It's why strangers give organs to other strangers. There is this high aspect among humans that really doesn't exist at this level in any other species on planet Earth. And so the light answered my question. So when the light answered my question, then I said, well, where does religion come from then? Where does all this come from? And from Christ, the whole thing opened up like a lotus opening up, and I saw a whole, I call it the God stream of consciousness. I got to see all the stream of consciousness of all the religions that have ever been on planet Earth from the present. And there are about 300 new religions on planet Earth just since the 20th century, if you want to look at it. There's new religions all the time. And reformations of religions, even Islam is having a reformation. But I saw that every one of these came from the other. They all come from the same stream of consciousness. In other words, Christianity is a Jewish religion. Judaism is a Mideast, Arabian, Egyptian religion. And it goes on and on and on, how one came out of the other. But when fundamentalism takes over religion, they want you to believe they invented God, and this is the only God, and my God's better than you, and if my God tells me to kill you, I can. That's the bizarre part of religion. But the highest aspect of all these religions is something very special, really, if you get to the pure essence of it.
You know, it sounds to me, I don't know why I'm remembering this based on what you've said, but I remember when I was 10 years old and I was at school, and the way kids would threaten me is it's, my dad could beat up your dad, or my brother could beat up your brother. And I was thinking, this is how religion works. Somebody who isn't me can beat up somebody who isn't you. Really? Well, thank you very much for enlightening me. What's going to happen now? Mm-hmm. And what's happened, I think, in the entirety of human history is that people have taken one truth and multiplied it into something that's completely untrue. And this is where cults come from, I think. And we have in society now these, I don't know, they're almost decentralized cult things, you know, like there'll be a personality cult around one particular activist or something of that nature. And anybody criticizes that person, you get massive trolls on your websites and things of this nature. It's like, people have forgotten the real truth of things, as you're talking about, is that, you know, our higher self is about loving each other just because we can, not because we have to.
Or because we've been commanded by some deity somewhere to do all of this. This is something very valuable about humans and the nature of the planet and the nature of humans is our ability to love and have empathy and compassion is amazing. And that's a human incredible aspect of grace on this planet.
Yeah, I think we really got to kind of harness compassion in general. And it's something that's sort of been bred out of the political class to a large degree. And as we were mentioning earlier on in the show, you know, you've known people who've become millionaires and suddenly they stop caring about everybody else. They lose their compassion. And maybe it's because they're not suffering along with the rest of us.
I've seen it happen a number of times. You get insulated and you forget other people have to pay bills. In my experience, the millionaires that I've hung out with, because I'm an inventor, is I'll give you two examples. The self-made millionaire will buy you lunch. Usually the person that inherited all the money doesn't. I've seen it repeatedly. Isn't that interesting?
That's very interesting. Well, is that because the self-made person appreciates what he's got and he's very generous with it?
I think so, and they're just being born into it. I've just noticed that difference in my life of dealing with business people, and there's a difference between self-made people and those that have just inherited everything.
And in fact, we were discussing this yesterday on the show. It might have been the day before yesterday. Anyway, my mate Fred Rex, he's also got a show on this network. He used to live in one of those areas where the rich go to play and have their holidays and things like that. And he used to hang out with a lot of the young kids that would come in with daddy's credit card or whatever. And not only could they just suddenly buy a dirt bike and all the great gear and stuff like that, so he could come around and play with all the local kids and stuff like that, who maybe had really crappy gear by comparison. And they'd go around to their big mansions and drink all their booze and smoke all their weed and what have you. But what was really interesting to him is that he could take care of himself, and he was homeless for a period of time, you know, or close enough to being homeless, and he could still take care of himself. Whereas these kids couldn't take care of themselves at all. They could barely tie their own shoelaces, couldn't really drive a car and what have you. And they become really dependent ultimately. And that was their real pitfall, is if you haven't been challenged enough to earn what you have, you become dependent on what you have in perpetuity until you lose it.
It's interesting. It's very, very interesting how all that how all that plays out. It's just very interesting. You know, when I was in school, I had a meeting with my guidance counselor. There comes a time, maybe the 10th grade, where in America, they used to want you to think about what you want to be when you grow up. Do you want to go to college, or do you want to be a tradesman? What do you want to be? Think about it, and then you're supposed to think about it for a couple of weeks. And I did, very deeply, and my appointment came with the guidance counselor, and I went down and had my appointment. He said, "Have you thought about what you want to be?" And I said, "Yes, I have. I put a lot of thought into it." He said, "Well, what is that?" And I said, "I want to be a philanthropist." He said, "Do you have any rich relatives?" And I said, "No." And the next thing I know, I'm in wood shop making bookcases. I didn't understand that to be a philanthropist, you had to actually have some money. I just wanted to give away money.
Well, I guess the guidance counselor must have been philanthropist at you. what I found very interesting is that children are expected to discover who they are and what they want to be before they've had any life experience. Doesn't that seem fracking insane to you?
Well, we're really pushed that way. You know, our education system kind of does that to us. It kind of industrializes all of us, including outsourcing our real self to others. But a new education system like Montessori and others, Steiner and all those kind of education systems are about creating a superior human being first, a problem solver, a resolution oriented. And this is something that, especially in America, we're not getting at all in our... and you've got to get this in when you're young, really. And so we should be producing superior human beings, and then engineers, and then lawyers, and then, you know, everything else. But what we're trying to do is just make everybody be acceptable, you know, an acceptable engineer, an acceptable this, acceptable that, and pretty much outsource your whole life to someone else.
Yeah. I say, to hell with being acceptable, let's try being exceptional.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
What the hell is the point in fitting into a crowd? You know, I'm 6'4". I can't fit into a crowd if I tried. And what was interesting is, like, people, I come out and I do this, and I do this radio show, and I'm out there with the giant megaphones and blaring up and getting in the face of the politicians and everything. People are like, "Vinny, aren't you afraid that they'll come after you?" And so, and my standard response is, "Dude, I'm 6'4". What the frack can I hide from?"
Well, you know, it's an amazing experience. You know, I've had the bureaucrats come after me a couple of times for my inventions because they just didn't like quantum biology or something like that. And I've had to deal with that, but have survived it. And people don't understand, what the local officials in your town and your state have more power over you than the central government, than the president of the country. And these are the people that really can do more to you, and you never pay attention to them, the power that they have, the local authorities and I've had one major invention that was in a clinical study pulled because they didn't like the word quantum biology, the health department, so to speak. But we were right in the middle of FDA process when it happened. They didn't care. They just came in with both boots and embargoed that piece of equipment, which I eventually got back, you know. But so unless you've been raided, and I have, unless you've been persecuted, and I have, you really don't understand the power of the locals around you, the city and the state and that sort of thing. I've had those experiences. I've survived them without a negative attitude. I realize that there are dragons we have to face, especially if you're a pioneer or if you're going to be exceptional. You're going to have some people in your way just trying to be exceptional at anything that you do. But I've persevered. I keep inventing. I have technology in 15 countries now. And these battles come along the way if you get out front. You know, it's always the people in the back of the line that are the safest.
Well, I think there's this developmental problem is like a prison, for instance. It actually costs a shockingly large amount of money and is a full-time job in order to keep prisoners in prison. And while you're busy keeping other people in prison, you're not improving yourself or improving society in any way, shape, or form. You're simply trying to prevent other people from making it bad. And as a result, you don't make things any better. And that's the society as the way it is. People make a more massive effort to prevent people from being exceptional than they do from improving themselves or society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the prison industry is quite huge in America, and I live in California. It's huge in California. I mean, they have a political power, the prisons and the companies that run them. And if you look at most of the people in prisons in America, it's for nonviolent crimes, actually. I mean, it's costing a fortune, and it's not really rehabilitating anyone, you know. So that's a serious problem in this country, but it's become an industry. It's become a huge industry, even... you know, there have been a number of scandals in America on these prisons for children. And they have...
Yeah, juvie.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. This is not enlightened, but these things will change because if something gets too big, you can't support it anymore. And for the state of California, so much money is going to these kind of things, you can't even pay for schools anymore. I have schools in my local area that can't buy new books, desks, or chairs, and students are not allowed to bring their books home. Ridiculous, isn't it?
You know what's more important? Just think about this. You know, he's just a dude in a boardroom, and it's just like he's got the state budget in front of him. Okay, what's a higher priority? Children's education to keep them out of prison, or financing the prisons to keep people in prison around other prisoners that will make them reoffend and go back to prison?
It's really an old paradigm, and you know, the old paradigm's become so expensive now, it's breaking everybody. You know, the old paradigm of war and attacking people, all of that has become so expensive now, it's breaking everybody, which in a way is kind of what has to happen. You know, things get so big till they break. And then that's when the new systems reform. It's sad it has to go this way because it's hurting all of us. It's hurting everyone that's not in prison, you see? So these are the kind of things that will change because the system cannot carry this much longer.
Yeah. Well, what I find interesting is they're now turning the schools themselves into prisons. You see that with all the kids being searched before they go in with the metal detectors, bars on the windows, that kind of thing. It's like... going to prison is sort of like going to college now. You know, you've graduated from mini prison and you're going into a larger, more extravagant prison.
Okay.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Prisoner theme song. Oh, He's not going to keep playing it, is he? All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about trying to get out of here in terms of the prison planet of some description that we happen to be living in, behind bars of varying descriptions, bars on your mind, bars on your body, and bars on your soul. And oh my goodness, we're trying to bake you a cake with a nice file in there so you can, like, get that freaking, get the breakout going. We want you to break out, ladies and gentlemen, like pimples on a teenager. I'm sorry. I kind of go too far with the puns and metaphors and things sometimes, don't I?
Some people are trapped behind chocolate bars, though, struggling with that.
That's true. Well, if they're trapped behind chocolate bars, they're also trapped inside this massive blob of a body that they've got there. And if they've been trapped behind enough chocolate bars, they probably are so big that they won't be able to get out of their house. And if they die, we'll need both a crane and a piano box at their funeral.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really sad. And I was talking to my mother a little under a month ago. And I asked her about you know, people being fat and stuff like that, and what was it like when she was a little girl? How many fat people did you see walking around? And she says, you know, it's actually really not ridiculously different to today. But one thing she did notice that was very different is that Maori, the you know, local indigenous population of New Zealand, it was very, very rare to see one of them that was overweight. And today, they have one of the highest obesity rates in the developed world. And this is actually the case with so many quote-unquote minority groups, is that they're actually more affected by the poisons and chemicals and fatty foods and things like that on a race-wide level than Caucasians are. Like even fluoride, for example, affects black people twice as much as it affects white people. And about Hispanics also affected about 50% more by fluoride than white people as well. It's really weird. It's almost as if there's a massive eugenics program to wipe out people that are quote unquote undesirable.
Well, you know, as a species, we've been going through this, you know, since the New World was discovered and sugar and all that was discovered. But it really, this obesity thing really took off about 1975 when Cereal Corporation got fraudulent FDA approval for aspartame, which became sucrose.
And the guy
that invented fructose.
Rumsfeld.
Rumsfeld. He was head of that company at the time. But the man that invented it, I saw an interview with him recently, and he says it was one of the biggest mistakes he ever made, because we now know all these years later that if you put fructose, and they do it in baby formula and everything, peanut butter, all the kids' foods, if you do this to children, it turns off the leptins in their brain permanently. The leptins let you know when you're full. And there's a direct connection to the obesity rise in all cultures. And since 1975, there's a direct path, a direct chart that you can chart out related to that. And now you have the inventor of fructose saying it was a huge mistake. They thought it was healthy. They thought it was going to replace sugar, but it was a big mistake.
Yeah, well, maybe he didn't pay attention to the fact that it killed every single rat in the tests.
Yeah, they got that through with a lot of friends at FDA.
Yeah, and the FDA is bringing down the United States health. Just isn't it interesting how those who are appointed to do a job are actually there to do the direct opposite of what their job description is? Food and Drug Administration, there to ensure food and drugs in America are safe. They're actually there to ensure that they're dangerous. Commander in chief, you know, there to command effectively a country and at wartime, you know, you use intelligence and special resources and things like that in order to get threats eliminated. But they don't. They simply get the country into massive debt and create enemies everywhere they go.
Well, you know, especially it began a little before, but especially with Bill Clinton's administration, the government has been turned over to industry to run the government, and the FDA got reorganized to where the companies are self-regulating now, and they have to pay, the companies pay fees, and that's what it's all about. That you've got the corporations running FDA, you've got the corporations running the Congress, running the government, and this all happened. This just happened to us inch by inch, and really got accelerated by Bill Clinton and everyone after that. And
he now. Wasn't he the one who repealed Glass-Steagall, the one that made fraudulent gambling derivatives illegal?
He and his good friend, who was a chairman of Wells Fargo Bank, and look how much trouble Wells Fargo got into. You know, Bill Clinton was a friend of the bankers for sure.
Okay, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, just understand something. If somebody comes at you saying they're trying to help you, assume, until you've seen the evidence, that they're trying to kill you. And 90% of the time, you'll actually be correct. Maybe even 99% of the time. And yes, I do realize the irony that 90% of all statistics are made up. including vote counts, I would assume. And it occurs to me, at least, that the entire system, and this is kind of everything. What was it? Was it Bertrand Russell who said, you know, the government's supposed to take care of the people from cradle to grave, or something like that? Some old philosopher. And I don't think that you're supposed to be taken care of your whole life. I think you're actually supposed to suffer through a good chunk of your life so that you learn valuable lessons in it. There is no real value without pain.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Well, that's certainly the old paradigm. You know, I heard a good joke the other day. A friend was telling me, why is Earth one of the most favorite reincarnation destinations for souls? And I said, why? And he said, this is where you come when you need a break from eternal bliss. So don't expect it here. You're on vacation from eternal bliss. You can always have it, but you're on vacation.
And the irony being is that we're supposed to be here for the alleged pursuit of happiness. I don't know. I seem to be in the pursuit of scumbaggery.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, happiness is a very subjective thing to people. You know, bringing happiness to others or happiness to yourself, very, very subjective, you know, what happiness really is. So the pursuit of happiness, I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? I can do whatever I want. It's very, very undefinable.
Well, I think happiness is a carrot that's dangled in front of you that you'll never reach.
Yeah, pretty much like heaven.
Yeah, and I thought about making this picture of a horse with blinders on, with a carrot in front of him, and he's trying to go after the carrot, and he's hauling an entire carriage of carrots behind him,
mm-hmm.
and it says, this is the economic model.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Teach
yeah.
people to follow something that they'll never get, never realizing mm-hmm. that the entirety of what they want, they've already got it on their backs. If only they would take their blinders off and stop trying to chase after things they can never get.
Well, it's very, very true. This is how so much has been pulled over on us, and why all of our wealth and all of our energy has been robbed from us, you know, so far. When we have all the power, we have all the access, we have more votes than they do. So when someone says, you know, I'm in the 99%, I say, that's great. 99% is a lot more powerful than 1%. It really is. You've got to turn that around.
Well, see, what I find interesting is that 1% of the people in this world do 99% of the work.
And, you know, that's the way it's going to be in the future, too, because the future that I've been shown that's coming is a future in which most people are not expected to work. And, you know, all the drudgery, all of that are replaced by our robots today. You know, it's the what really freed the slaves in 1807 was not so much all the do-gooders, although they were really trying and they meant well. It was the Industrial Revolution. Suddenly, you know, before the Industrial Revolution, the only way you could be rich is having lots of servants and slaves and serfs. But after the Industrial Revolution, you could become very wealthy just owning machines. And so that really freed the slaves more than anything else. And just as that pattern, our artificial intelligence, our technologies of today will free us into the future. And this is why I was told by the light that the people of the future think of us who are living now as the giants of history. We think of ourselves as some hairy worm that's eating every leaf on the tree, some ugly thing. But we don't realize that we're in the process of metamorphosis. We're in the process of becoming something we can't imagine, like a butterfly.
Yeah. And currently we're encased in a chrysalis, but within it, we're developing into something beautiful, something grand, something that we were meant to develop into throughout our entire existence. That's a very encouraging thought.
It's been a continuum getting to where we are, and where we're going is really cool, because in the future, most people are not expected to work. There'll always be the A types who want to do things, fine, but you don't need people running the sewage plants. You don't have any of that anymore. In some of my seminars, I do an exercise with people saying that this is as close as one or two incarnations from now, because I really believe in reincarnation since my near-death experience. But the point is that try for the first time in your life to imagine a lifetime which you did not have to work for survival, food, or travel. What would you do with your life then? Start thinking about that. What would you do with your life if you didn't have to spend all your time surviving?
You know, I don't have to spend virtually any of my time surviving. And it's because I decided that my life was worth more than menial existence, that I was meant for something greater than making money for other people off of products that don't change the world and don't make a difference. As soon as I decided that I did want to make a difference, that I did want to change the world, I started going out and doing it, survival became natural. Thank you, Melon, for coming on the show. Melon-Thomas.com. It's been a great pleasure. And we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.